Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in East European Studies podcast series. I am your host, Amanda Swain. Today, we'll be talking with Magda Romanska about her recent book, The Post-Traumatic Theater of Gotovsky and Cantor, History and Holocaust in Acropolis and Dead Class, published by Anthem Press. Both Cantor and Gotovsky were acclaimed in the West for their avant-garde theater productions in the 1960s and 1970s, receiving high critical regard despite the fact that critics and audiences could not understand the Polish language of their plays. Romanska argues not against Cantor's and Gotovsky's influence on avant-garde theater, but rather for a more nuanced understanding of their work. As she states in her introduction, this book attempts the impossible, to turn back the clock and re-deliver both Gotovsky and Cantor in all their obscure, difficult, multi-layered, funny-sounding Polish glory, with all of the complex and convoluted contextual and textual details of their two seminal performance pieces, Acropolis and Dead Class. I found this to be a fascinating study of two playwrights and two plays, of Polish culture and of avant-garde theater. I'm looking forward to discussing the book with Magda today. So welcome to New Books in East European Studies, Magda.
Thank you, Amanda. Thank you for having me. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, good. Well, I'm looking forward to our conversation about your book, but perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in this topic and in studying Polish theater.
Well, I grew up in Poland, and I moved to the US when I was in my early 20s. So I became interested in theater in general first. And then there seemed to be a gap in the scholarship, in American scholarship, on the topic of Polish theater, despite the fact that Polish theater has been so influential on American avant-garde, particularly, you know, since the 60s. And so there seemed to be a need to provide a kind of a contextual historical analysis of those two very influential avant-garde directors. So I seem to be, you know, the right person for the job, so to speak, having grown up in that culture and also understanding American academia and American theater. At the crossroad of those two cultural landscape, it seemed a natural research topic for me.
Great. And to start off, why don't you tell us briefly about Cantor and Gotovsky and their influence on avant-garde theater in the 1960s and 1970s? And perhaps as part of that, you can explain the difference for us between Cantor's poor theater and Gotovsky's poor theater.
Well, we have to understand something. After the World War II, when the communist, Polish communist government actually spent quite a lot of money on art in Poland, and particularly on theater, because it was seen as a kind of postcard, a business card of how well artists are doing in Poland, and so government would spend and support all sorts of different avant-garde experiments, which then they would send to different festivals and abroad to showcase what a great theater Poland had. And so out of that climate, it was a very fruitful climate in many ways, despite the fact that there was a censorship and despite all of the other limitations, politically speaking, it was also a very a nurturing environment for the artists. And they had to sort of learn to speak between the lines, to say things that could not be said openly. And art thrives on limits in some way. And so the symbolic language that both of them are using had a chance to develop and to grow out of that environment, out of that climate. And by the time, when Gotovsky came to America in the late 60s, and when Cantor came to America in mid 70s, this was a very ripe ground, very ripe moment for American culture to receive the type of avant-garde experimentations in theater. Particularly Gotovsky was especially influential. His philosophy of work, of art, of theater seemed to mesh very well with the late 60s philosophy espoused by many artists of the moment, of a kind of a search for yourself, search for broader meaning, trying to find some communal experience in artistic endeavor. And so he seemed to match very well with the current, with the zeitgeist of the moment. Cantor did not match as well. By the time he came in the late 60s with his production of Dead Class to New York, the environment changed a little bit, and he was never as embraced by American avant-garde and by American academic circles and artistic circles in the same way that Grotowski was embraced. There was a sort of a subculture of people who were interested in Cantor, and Grotowski became more of a, I would say, mainstream theater person. But nonetheless, among the people who did know about Cantor and who did like his work, he has been very influential. You know, people like Moise Kaufman, who was one of the authors of the Laramie Project, for example, and Robert Wilson are very influenced by Cantor's work. So those influences are kind of, we can see them throughout the even modern American theater. We can see them kind of resurfacing in different works, in different people's work. Mm-hmm.
And they both espouse something called poor theory, which in English it's poor theory, but the Polish phrases are different, and their approaches and what they meant by poor theory were different.
Yeah, it's that the poor theater, the concept of poor theater it's kind of a little bit ironic, because they both, Cantor and Grotowski, kind of didn't like each other very much, and they believe that each one of them is original in its own right. And in Polish language, there's two concepts, teatr biedny and teatr ubogi, are very different concepts. But in American, you know, in English and in German and in French, this has been always translated by one term, a poor theater. But it's a little bit different concept. In Grotowski, poor theater means that you basically are getting rid of the props, the set, everything else that's not really necessary, people lived for expression, and you only leave an actor. The theater cannot happen without an actor. Like, the actor is the grounding, the focal point of any artistic theatrical representation. And so basically, poor theater is a theater in which you only work with your own body, with your own emotions, and with your own physicality. For Cantor, the word poor theater had a little bit more nuanced meaning. It not just denoted a poverty, like being poor, but also a certain sense of being desolate, being abandoned, being left in the, you know, for being left out of on the desert or anywhere in some kind of a vast landscape. So this word poor theater means it's a theater of people, objects discarded, those things, emotions, marginalized human beings, the object found, he comes from Duchamp's concept of a found object, but also the idea of found people, the people who have been discarded, marginalized. So this theater is trying to excavate that kind of poor world. The world of people and objects which have been, left and discarded in some way, and mm-hmm. so there is a little bit different meaning in the way that they both approach of poor theater, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that Grotowski and Cantor were received differently in the West, and particularly in the United States, but they were also received differently in Poland. Can you talk about that and about how, even though they were both drawing from the same Polish cultural and literary roots, their work was actually perceived quite differently within Poland.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting to see how those two directors were received in Poland. Grotowski was always treated a little bit with suspicion, mostly because I think that seems to me is because of his the idea that he was trying to kind of explore to bridge sacred with the profane, and that didn't really mesh with Polish culture and with the way that even Polish artists understand the role of theater. Theater in Poland is an intellectual affair. It isn't supposed to be like a spiritual journey. Like if you want a spiritual journey, you go to like church or synagogue. You know, you don't try to replicate a godly feeling in theater. And that's not how Polish actors are trained to act. They are trained to transmit certain intellectual and emotional as well, but not in the way that's supposed to like take you in and completely, you know, change your whole framework. It's not, theater doesn't try to be a church. And in Grotowski, sort of mixing this ritual with theatrical experience, he was trying to replicate that kind of church-like emotion. You know, Peter Brook called his spectacle Acropolis Black Mass. And in Poland, Grotowski was always kind of seen like a little bit cultish. Like, the people who sort of didn't really have their stuff together would be going, working for Grotowski, trying to find themselves. You're supposed to go to theater and work in theater once you already found yourself and you know what you want to do. Grotowski's group functioned as a sort of a way vehicle for trying to find yourself. The art and theater as a vehicle of trying to find yourself. And that doesn't really mesh well with Polish spirit, so to speak. Like Poles are much more, not cynical, but more enjoy more irony and enjoy more kind of ironic and detached way of dealing with serious issues, the kind of approach that combines the tragic with the grotesque, you know, uses a kind of a black humor to deal with the history and to deal with all of the horrible things that happened, you know, to Poland throughout the last, you know, three centuries. And so that kind of seriousness and the lack of irony and the lack of sense of humor, the kind of earnestness of Grotowski's work didn't really mesh well with Polish psychic. Cantor, on the other hand, people always had a certain reverence and respect for him, and he has been always well known, even among people who were not involved in theater. He's a basically household name, like everybody knows who Cantor is in Poland. But his work was blending that kind of tragic, ridiculous, absurd aspect of life with more serious aspects of life. And so it was kind of always more fitting, more in tune with the Polish, with the way that Poles deal with reality, with the way that Poles deal with their history. And his work is also a kind of a blend of those tragic moments that turn into grotesque and vice versa. Grotesque moments that turn into tragic moments, and so the line between the tragedy and grotesque is very thin. And at any minute, you don't know you're gonna laugh or you're gonna cry. You're sort of always on the edge between those two. So this was the major difference, and this is one reason why I think people in Poland just didn't really wanted to connect. Didn't really wanted to engage with Grotowski as much. He seemed too artificial in some way. In his earnestness, he seemed too self-righteous.
Well, I'd like to take each of these and works in turn and talk about them in more detail, because you argue that the subtleties in the Polish cultural context of both of their works, particularly in Acropolis and The Dead Class, are lost in what you say is the lack of translation, because the plays were performed in Polish in the West, and therefore neither the critics nor the audiences actually understood the text of the plays. So let's first look at Grotowski's Acropolis, which you call an attempt to capture, condense, and understand the new 20th century Polish consciousness, one forever framed by the smoke from the Auschwitz ovens. So can you first, in a sense, set the stage for us and tell us about what this play, and describe the play and its production, so that then we can talk about the actual meanings and interpretations in the play?
The production of Acropolis was based on this play of the same title by Stanisław Wyspiański, who was a late 19th, early 20th century Polish playwright, but also a painter and an architect. And the one thing which Wyspiański did way before any other European playwrights have done so, he wrote those monumental works which combined all kinds of different elements from drama, opera, and visual art, and they were a blend of different genres and different different approaches. So this is a sort of he was fascinated by Wagner's a term of total artwork, artwork which would combine all different artworks, and so Acropolis is this blend of different genres, and the play takes place at Wawel, which is the Polish castle when the king used to reside, and it's the entire thing happens during one night when all of the images from the paintings in the castle come to life to tell a Polish history, basically. So what Grotowski did with this, he took this play and he put it, staged it in Auschwitz. But not so much staged a play in Auschwitz, but staged a play within a play. And let me explain it to you. His second and very important influence was Tadeusz Borowski, who was a Polish writer who most famous book is This Way, Ladies and Gentlemen, to the Ovens. It's a collection of short stories from the time when he was in Auschwitz. And Borowski's writing style is very difficult to read, because there is really no heroism in his writing. He basically narrates what happened with a kind of cold objectivity, trying to make the reader understand this world, in which the human values are completely reversed, and this becomes normalized. So there is nobody there who actually can question it, because it's normalized. The reversal of human values is so normalized that for us who read it, it's shocking. And so the one scene in one of the short stories, there is a scene where he describes how they work all day, they work until they die, and he wonders what's going to happen with us when the Nazi win. What's going to happen? The monuments that we built, the next generations are going to come, and they're going to admire those monuments. This is, he compares himself to the workers who built the pyramids. Nobody really knows who they were. We go to look at the pyramids. So what's going to happen when the Nazi win? Are they going to redefine what's justice, redefine what humanity? What's going to happen to poetry? What's going to happen to art? So he wonders about that. And so Grotowski took this one passage and created this spectacle in which the prisoners work to build an oven. They're building an oven in Auschwitz. And as they do that, to amuse themselves, to pass time, they perform scenes from Acropolis, from Wyspiański's Acropolis. So it becomes a kind of a meta play within the play in some way, where Borowski's story is a framework, and then Vispianski text becomes something that they performed as a way to pass the time. But then at some point we lose this meta distance, and the actors become who they perform. For the moment, they become, you know, Rachel. They become this. They become that. And so the idea for the production was kind of interesting, was that Grotowski was trying to keep his actors both very close to the audience members, but psychologically as if they were in different dimension. And so they are very much very close to the people that they perform, but there is a certain distance, psychological distance between them and the people that see the production. A lot of research that came out in Poland during that time was psychiatric research on the condition of Muslim men in Auschwitz, the idea how people survived. And so a lot of people who survived, in a way, survived because they tuned out. They became autistic, like almost extremely autistic, by turning off all of the psychological processes and just preoccupying themselves with pure survival. So Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben calls it a pure condition of pure life. You become pure life, but the psyche is gone. And so Grotowski was very much influenced by that research. This research came out like within 10, 15 years after the war in Poland. Psychiatrists were researching the survival, the survivors, and trying to figure out what happened, what psychologically happened when you're in these extreme conditions of extreme humiliation, hunger, and deprivation. And so what they found out is that people are kind of tuning out their psychology and all of the kind of what makes you human being. You turn it off. And so Grotowski was trying to like replicate that idea that you become a husk of a human being. You just become automatic. You perform certain movements. You think about survival, but there is really no life inside you. Like rather, you are a pure life without a soul, so to speak. And so this was one of the more interesting aspects of this production, but also one that brought a lot of controversy. Can't you really turn that experience into a formal theatrical experiment? What are the ethical dimensions of that choice, of that aesthetic choice? So this was one of the controversies that around that particular production. So,
mm-hmm. And as you explain in the book, Grotowski's playing with four layers: the reality of the spectators, the reality of the concentration camp, the reality of Vispianski's original Acropolis that the prisoners are reenacting, and then also Vispianski's skepticism about the national ideals of Polish martyrology. And obviously that seems like the one that would be most likely to be missed by audiences and critics who don't actually understand the Polish that's being spoken in the performance of the play. So what did these Western audiences miss and not understand about this play?
Well, the one thing which I think is important to remember, that a lot of theater that was happening in Poland at the time could not really talk about many things openly. So you had to use images and symbols to pass certain messages on. And if you don't know cultural context, you're going to miss those. So I'm going to give you one example. In Grotowski's In Acropolis, very often actors would lift their hands and move them in a kind of a dance, like leaves on the wind. In the wind, they would move their hands in above their heads, and American critics interpreted this as a comment on the indifference of nature to human suffering. But this was actually a very literal image of what happened to concentration camp inmates when they wanted to commit suicide. Or what they did, they would, you know, the only way to commit suicide, effective way, was to either run and then the guards would shoot, you know, would shoot you, or you threw yourself on the electric fence and you got electrocuted. So this was a quick way of killing yourself, and it, you know, it did give you back your autonomy. At least you were the one deciding when you wanted to die. And so so for many people, this was, you know, this was a viable option, yeah, to go. And with the prisoner threw themselves on the wires, this is what, how it was called, their body would be electrocuted and they would like shiver and shake for a while. And there are some pictures in archives, you know, around Europe that you can find those prisoners. And so unless you actually understand that, unless you know that this is what was happening, you can't really interpret this gesture. And you don't really know what it means. It's like, oh, they're dancing. But they're not really dancing. What they're saying is that these are human beings who are pushed to the extreme and they're reclaiming their agency, and they're reclaiming, the only way that they can do it is by this gesture of self, you know, of killing yourself. And this is a horrible death, you know, in some way, but it's still a death that you choose. And so there is, this is a very dense, image, that people just completely missed. And so there, you know, there are other images like this as well, both in Cantor and in Grotowski's, you know, work.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to Cantor's Dead Class now. So again, can you tell us about the play itself? Describe what's happening on stage and in this production, and particularly about Cantor's use of the grotesque.
So Dead Class was devised work that Cantor imagined himself. There is a text there. The text is based on Witkacz's play, Tumor Obrejnowicz. That's a silly little absurdist play. It was written by Witkacz at the, between the two wars. Witkacz was a kind of an enfant terrible of Polish culture. During the wars, that's where he worked most of his adult life. He was a painter and playwright and writer and novelist, and he was self-taught, and was very interested in sort of an abstract way of representing human experience, but also in kind of a formal experiments with the form. Witkacz came up with this idea of a theater of pure form, where theater would sort of comment on itself foremost, and that you not so much to be this kind of like experience, like lived experience, but to be more of an intellectual formal experience, which you can analyze, or which can tell you about something about human life, but not in that kind of realistic mode, but more in abstract, absurd mode. Witkacz's play often comment on that kind of pompous, you know, Polish martyrology or Polish history in many ways. The one thing about Witkacz that was sort of, I think it's important for us to keep in mind, is that when the Russian army entered Polish borders in 1939, Witkacz committed suicide. And so after war, when the Soviets came and the communist government was established, he became a sort of persona non grata, because how can you talk about Witkacz and not mention his suicide? And like, why did Witkacz kill himself? Because the Russian army entered Polish borders. But of course, nobody could talk about Russian army entering Polish borders, because this was not really how the history was being presented. Germans attack us, but not the Russians. Yeah. This was how the history was being manufactured. And so poor Witkacz, despite the fact that he was such a, he was so much ahead of his time in terms of his work, way ahead of the Theater of the Absurd, you know, way ahead of Beckett and Ionesco. He wrote those highly experimental absurdist dramas. But because politically it was, he was not mentionable, so to speak, he never really gained that much you know, esteem as he potentially could on, in European art world and in the global art world. And so Cantor was interested in Katsi for that particular, for many reasons, and he was sort of the first person who sort of excavated his work from oblivion. And so the text which they're performing, it's Tumor Brainovich. It's about this man who's so smart that he's almost stupid because he's too smart for his own good, so to speak. He's so smart, but he cannot really understand how the world works because he's blinded by his own intellect, so to speak. But Cantor's actors don't really perform the text so much. Like, it's, they like grasp to it bits and pieces, and the entire production is set in a classroom. This is a classroom from before World War One. They find out about World War One from the newspapers, and it's a kind of a ghastly classroom. We don't know, are those people alive? Are those people dead? Are they coming back to this classroom? Because they're all adults, but now they are being thrown back into this classroom where they enact this strange play, and sometimes they live the other parts, but sometimes they just kind of scream randomly the lines from the play, and so we don't know, are they ghosts, are they real, are they adults, are they children, like what are they? So in this is a memory play. This is a play that sort of tries to capture that idea of, you know, when you sit down and you look back at your life, like, you know, where, what the moment of childhood, what did become of us, what did happen to us, to all of the, you know, what happened to the people in this classroom. And so of course we know what happened to the people of this, in this classroom, you know, all of my majority of them probably have been killed during World War II. And so Cantor in some ways is trying to excavate, you know, his own childhood, but also this world of the lost world of Polish of Polish Jews, and it has been such an integral element of Polish society for such a long time, you know, almost 1,000 years of history, have been obliterated within the you know, 6 years. Before World War II, 1/3 of Polish society had Jewish you know, had Jewish origins, and after that there was almost nobody left. And so the death class is trying to almost like excavate that history and tell us that this is the, you know, this entire classroom is probably gone and there's nobody left. And so it operates with these images and with the symbols again, because this was not something that can be openly discussed. The Jewish martyrology was not something that could be openly discussed in 1960s or 70s in, you know, in Poland. And is trying to capture that sense of loss, of what has been lost, what can never be regained. So that's how the production is framed, so to speak.
It, like Grotowski's work, critics in the West said that you didn't have to actually understand Polish to understand the plays. But in this, you give the example that the critics would say that these actors were just shouting gibberish, but that the lines that they were saying would have been meaningful for a Polish audience. So what's one example of a line from the play that that Poles would understand, not as gibberish, but as something very specific?
Yeah, I'm going to give you an example of the image and some lines. So, for example, this one sentence, the Ides of March, this refers back to the Roman, the Roman story of the betrayal, but in Poland at the time it also referred to March 68, when the remaining Jews were expelled from Poland to Israel. due to the, you know, the communist government just basically shipped a bunch of citizens out of Poland, like they kicked them out. And so this was something that also was not being talked about in the mid-70s. And so when a contrast actor say Ides of March, it's not just refers to the Roman history, but it refers to very recent Polish history. And so you have to kind of know it. You have to understand, like you have to understand that this is what they're talking about, to know that this is what they're referring to. The one image that people might not understand, which seems like it's a funny image, you know, the guy takes that, he takes off his pants and everybody looks at him, yeah, like he's naked. What does it mean? And it's done in a kind of a funny way. So, you know, like the guy basically, moons everybody, yeah? And it sort of feels like it's a grotesque little moment when the guy takes off his pants, and it's always funny when the guy takes off his pants, yeah? But this is a very poignant scene, because that's how, you know, the Jews were identified. Take off your pants, yeah? Are you Jewish? Are you not? And so this scene, even though it's presented as being grotesque, it's extremely tragic. It's extremely loaded scene, because this talks about how your body can betray you. You're wearing on your body the mark of your culture, the mark of your people, and then it betrays you, and you're being killed. And so this decision of taking off your pants, it's a life and death moment. And so for American, you know, for people who don't know that, who don't know that this is how people have been identified by the Nazis, this just seems like it's a funny ha-ha-ha moment. And it does, there is an element of grotesque in that when you think about it. Like, and in some way, you know, Cantor makes us realize how grotesque this is. That this life and death decisions depend on such as silly things in some way, and so, you know, there is the kind of a bigger question about the nature of war and violence. Why do you choose to kill the other in some way? And those are typically very absurd, very grotesque reasons behind it. Yeah, and so so this scene is very loaded. As well. So if you don't understand those cues, those visual cues or those linguistic cues, the production can still speak to you, I think, and it has been speaking to people throughout the last, you know, 40 years. But I think it just enriches your understanding of it if you are able to read some of those signs.
So are these plays still being performed with some frequency, and how are the productions that are being done outside of Poland today, are they trying to draw out these cultural contexts, perhaps in, you know, program notes or introductions, or is it still, are these performances still done with an emphasis on their contribution to avant-garde theater?
Well, I think it's almost impossible to restage this exactly. And I don't think anybody would really attempt it. But people have been doing, you know, experiments of trying to do something that would also comment on the legacy of these works. So this year, because it's the 100th anniversary of Cantor's birth, there has been a lot of different events and productions happening around the world. One of the more interesting ones that's just taking place right now, if you're in Los Angeles and anybody out there, go see The Memory Machine by Lars America, who is doing a kind of a Cantor-esque performance about memory and the legacy of memory. So those things are being done here and there in the style of Cantor or influenced by Cantor or influenced by Grotowski, you know, Worcester Group. Did a kind of a metatheatrical version of Acropolis, with Acropolis being played on the screen, on the video, in the background. So people do make Vispiansky's Acropolis. You know, very difficult to do without acknowledging that Gotovsky did Vispiansky's production and how influential it was. So it's almost like he ruined the text for anybody else, because now you have to engage with him in some way whenever you want to go back to this original script. Cantor's work has been very influential on Polish playwrights. Even the production which people might be familiar with, of Tadeusz Słowodzianek's R Class, which deals with tells the story of a Polish Jews growing up to mend their fates and how they turn against each other. The R Class was very much influenced by Cantor's work, the setting of the play, and the way that the play is told was very much influenced by Cantor's idea of memory and his idea of going back to the past and looking at this moment of transition, of change, of when things broke apart in some way.
So now to just look at your study of these plays, you talk in the preface about how you had to draw from so many different disciplines and Slavic studies, history, critical theory, theater and performance studies. So how did you approach working from such diverse disciplinary perspectives on this work?
What's kind of an unfortunate thing is that historically we had theater departments and we had Slavic departments in the majority of American universities. And theater department would study theater, mostly Western theater, and the Slavic department would study Slavic literature and Slavic theater. And that Slavic drama, not theater, the kind of old 18th century dramatic tradition, was historically considered to be a dramatic literature. And it was not always, it has not been studied in theater departments. And so it's not being considered a part of the theatrical, global theatrical canon. It's being considered part of Eastern European literary canon. And so this is a kind of a strange institutional history, that legacy that we have to deal with. The people who do to write about Eastern European theater or Eastern European drama, we are kind of on the crossroad between all of those different ways of thinking about text and thinking about theatrical text. And so it was a little bit challenging, because I always felt like I was explaining things one way or the other for different groups. But I also wanted to provide a really deep contextual and historical analysis of these works. So the students of theater and the students of Slavic literature can look at them and can understand the kind of web of meaning, the way that literature and theater and history come together in theatrical work. I mean, that's why theater is so interesting, because it draws on all of those different trends, but all of those different moments. It tries to always be in the moment in response to what's going on in culture and in our historical circumstances. And so it was important to be that interdisciplinary in this particular context, in order for this create the discussion and create a common language between different scholars to be able to talk about those works and their connection to history and their connection to dramatic literature and their connection to Polish culture at large, and by extension to European culture. And to the legacy of that culture, and how do we really deal with that legacy?
And the title of your book identifies these plays as post-traumatic theater. So why this term, and why are trauma studies key to understanding these works?
No, there is the concept of post-dramatic theater, which Hans Lehmann, a German theorist, came up with. And for Lehmann, the idea of post-dramatic theater is a theater which is non-dialogic and nonlinear and theater, which basically is no longer set in the kind of a fictive universe that makes sense. So all of the postmodern theater works can be made defined as post-dramatic. And one point which Lehmann makes in his book is that in some way, perhaps we can ask whether this post-dramatic theater, which is non-linear, non-dialogic, non-chronological, whether it was in some way the only way to respond to the trauma of World War II, when the language sort of failed, when there was no longer possibility of creating a coherent dramatic narrative with the dramatic arc and catharsis at the end, that seemed to be cathartic moments seemed to elude, seemed to be no longer an adequate response to what happened in World War II, in some way facing to what happened, the kind of a mass genocide on the scale that's previously unthink of. How do we deal with it? How do we, as a humanity, come to terms with what happened, and how do we understand ourselves in the context of what happened? And this two terms, post-dramatic and post-traumatic, almost they sort of come together in some way. Trauma is the breakdown in narrative. The world no longer makes sense. You cannot really restructure it so easily with the narrative linear way of thinking through what happened. You describe it, you absorb it, you talk about it in bits and pieces, and making sense out of it in the same way that the traditional realist drama makes sense of the world with the narrative arc, with the cathartic moment at the end, that this is no longer possible to do with the traumatic event. That you can process it and maybe represent it, but in a way that's not going to be so neat and so pretty and so tied up with that classic dramatic structure, that it's going to be broken down and the meaning will not be easily discernible.
So we've talked a lot about your books, but there may be a question that I didn't ask or something that you think is important in your work. So this is an opportunity for you to tell us if there's just something else about your book that I didn't bring up.
I think what's interesting about Polish culture in particular is that because of its central location in the middle of Europe, between those different forces, it's a very interesting culture that sort of unwillingly captures a certain contradictory trends in our global culture as well. Those works of art, the Ida, the Polish film, which is where won Oscar, the works of art that come out of Poland are always have to grapple with not just with the Polish specific history and experience, but have to kind of grapple with the global currents as well, because those global currents are running through, the country in some way, if that makes. So I think that there's two works that came out of Poland and that were so influential for both European and American theater. The one reason perhaps why they were so influential is that they sort of captured all of these anxieties, all of these contradictions of what it means to live in the modern world in some way. And how do you know yourself, and how do humanity comes with the power it has to destroy each other in some way.
So thank you for giving us so much of your time. This has been a really interesting conversation. I always enjoy talking to scholars about their books and hearing their perspective on their work. And so I'd like to close by asking you what you're working on now.
Right now I'm trying to the project that I'm working on is on posthumanism, and the idea of kind of what happens after the end of the humanist ethics, so to speak, and the way that theater and art and representation deals with this representations of the bionic bodies that cross over between human and human. You know, should we be scared of it? Should we welcome it? What does it really mean for us? And also in the context of in the broader context of what it means for our own understanding of what it means to be a human being. In some way, historically, theater and art has always struggled with this idea of what it representing, you know, what it means to be human versus all the other unhuman objects and subjects. And so right now, this question becomes more and more prominent, crossover between humans and machines. Those crossovers happen more and more often. Is this something that we should worry about, or is this something that we should embrace? And so the research that I'm doing has to do also with the representation of the disabled in our culture, and how unwittingly they become in some way pioneers of that post-human aesthetic. So that's sort of my new project.
Well, hopefully we'll have an opportunity to interview you about a book on that project in a few years from now. But this has been a wonderful conversation, and thank you very much for joining us. And also thanks to our listeners for listening in today, and we look forward to next month's conversation about a new book in East European Studies.